I'd like to read Ecclesiastes 3 in a couple of verses, and then I'll go to a verse in Jeremiah a little later. But to begin with, let me read Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 1. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. And I'll stop reading there. And you know, Ecclesiastes is a book that God moved Solomon to write, as he gave Solomon tremendous riches and glory and honor and wisdom, earthly wisdom. And he gave Solomon much wisdom. And then God moved Solomon to write. And this was a true expression of Solomon's experience. He felt this way. He wasn't writing lies. God moved him to write, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And the word vanity is a word that really means empty, vain. Something vain is an empty thing. So if we're vain, if I'm a vain person, it's not saying anything good about me. It's saying something pretty bad about me. And that's the idea about vanity in this life. All is vain and empty. And yet God had a purpose for this world, and He had a purpose for permitting man, creatures made in His image, to fall into sin, and for the world to see corruption, and for all the evil. God allowed it. He permitted it in order for Him finally at the end to be glorified through His salvation plan. And we know that God likens His salvation plan to he likens it to growing fruit, to growing vegetables, to producing a harvest. He has a few ways that He illustrates it. One way is through a building. We're living stones, and He's building a building, or He's building a city, the New Jerusalem, or He's building a wall, Nehemiah's wall in 52 days. All that building is pointing to those that become saved and they hear the gospel and they become part of the kingdom of God, part of that construction. But He also speaks a lot in the Bible of vineyards and of fields and of planting seed. Christ spoke a parable of sharing the word, and as the word is shared, it's like throwing seed. A sower goes out to sow, and he throws seed here and he throws seed there, and God speaks of His gospel as those who sow, like that excellent psalm that Robert read just a little earlier. Psalm 126 says in verse 5, "They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him." Now, that's all spiritual language. Christ spoke a parable, and as he spoke of sowing seed, and then he explained it. The seed is the word. So there's no question God uses this kind of illustration to teach the spiritual truths that He is, He's a husbandman, according to the Gospel of John. Jesus is the vine, and He is the husbandman who is patiently waiting for the precious fruit of the earth. That's one way to summarize the reason why the whole world continues up until now. As it says in James 5, in verse 7, Be patient therefore, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman, and John 15:1 tells us the Father is the husbandman. The husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth and has long patience for it until he receive the early and latter rain. So God is the husbandman. And there is fruit. There is fruit on the earth because he sowed seed. And yet the fruit isn't quite ready. So he's waiting for the fruit to mature, for the fruit to grow up to a point. No one harvests their field before the fruit is ready. That would defeat the purpose. That wouldn't be a smart thing to do or a wise thing to do for anybody to plant the crops and then they're in such a hurry to make money or to bring their crops in that they harvest it before it's ready, before the time. Well, God, of course, is not unwise. He's very wise. And so he has the field and he has planted his fruit and he's waiting to collect it. He's waiting to gather it. And what's he waiting for? The early and the latter rain. And the early rain, he's not waiting for that anymore because that fell during the church age. And God did gather in the fruit from the church age. He speaks of that as the first fruits. And he likens it to 144,000 in Revelation 7, 12,000 from 12 tribes. And in Revelation 14, he calls the 144,000 first fruits. And then in Revelation 7, after the 144,000 have been sealed, it says in verse 8 of Revelation 7, of the tribe of Zebulun were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Joseph were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Benjamin were sealed 12,000. After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number. So the early rain fell. God began to collect the harvest, the 144,000. Not a literal number, but it represents all those saved during the New Testament church age, the 1955 years. And that ended in 1988. The church age came to an end. After this, there's a great multitude. And God, if we would go on and read in Revelation 7, speaks of that great multitude coming out of great tribulation. And that's why we know the church age ended, 23 years began, May 21, 1988 until May 21, 2011, of the great tribulation. And God is now turned his attention from the first fruits to all the rest that he will save during this period that we call the latter rain. We call this the latter rain because the husbandman's waiting for the precious fruit of the earth until he received the early rain, he has it, and the latter rain. And then the implication is he's not going to wait anymore. He's long-suffering, patient. He's not enduring with the world's sins so the world can continue on with its plans. That's not why the world is here. God isn't waiting for people to, for instance, go to college to get educated. He's not waiting for someone to get that job that they've always wanted. He's not waiting for someone to find marriage and to raise children and have a family. Because that's always going to be the case. Whenever Christ would come, it would necessarily have to interrupt people's lives. Wouldn't it? If you put it off 1,000 years. Well, 1,000 years, people would have lives just like we have lives today. And there would still be someone saying, oh, it's not fair. I'm only a teenager. I'm only a young man or a young woman. I haven't had a chance to live. That would be said at any point, at any generation, that God determined to end the world. And so that's not something that God is waiting for. He's not waiting for you or for me or for anyone to experience certain things in this world. Especially since most of our experiences are rebellion against Him. Why would God wait for people to live up to the fullness of their rebellious potential? He's not doing that. He's not doing that. He's waiting for one reason. If we look at 2 Peter, God actually states it matter-of-factly in 2 Peter 3 and verse 15. In 2 Peter 3 is the chapter where God describes melting this earth with fervent heat and the whole universe being dissolved. And he says, after making those statements in verse 15, an account that the long suffering of our Lord is salvation. The husbandman waiteth, and he has long suffering for the precious fruit. He's waiting for the early and latter rain because account. We could just understand that as this equals. The reason is that when God is long suffering, the reason is salvation. The reason is the great multitude that have not come in yet in their fullness, in their completeness. The Lord still has some to save. I don't know how many, but He will complete it by May 21 of 2011. And that's how God, one way that God views this world, it's like the whole earth is a field. And He's going to wait up to a point. For instance, Mark 4 says in verse 28, "For the earth bringeth forth fruit of herself, first the blade, then the ear, after that the full corn in the ear. But when the fruit is brought forth, immediately he putteth in the sickle, because the harvest is come." He's not patient anymore. He's not long suffering anymore. He's not waiting anymore, because he was only waiting for the fruit. And immediately he then harvests the crop. And we know May 21 will be a day of resurrection, the day of rapture, which basically is the day of gathering. Yeah, and God uses that phrase of gathering the elect from the four winds. He gathers them together. And what's He say about those He's going to leave behind? They were not gathered. They're left on the open ground. Those that came up out of the ground, they're just left, their remains, they're ungathered. They're like rotten fruit. They brought forth a stench is one way that God speaks of it. And so this is a major way, actually, that God looks at His salvation plan in the Bible as a field that will eventually be harvested. Now, if you turn to Jeremiah chapter 8, I'm just going to read one verse. I'm not. In Jeremiah 8, let me read the first couple of verses, and then I'll go to another verse that I wanted to go to. It says in verse 1, "At that time, saith Jehovah, they shall bring out the bones of the kings of Judah, and the bones of his princes, and the bones of the priests, and the bones of the prophets, and the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem out of their graves. And they shall spread them before the sun and the moon and all the host of heaven, whom they have loved and whom they have served and after whom they have walked and whom they have sought and whom they have worshipped. They shall not be gathered nor be buried. They shall be for dung upon the face of the earth." God isn't collecting them. They're not good fruit. Remember in Jeremiah also, we have God looking at good figs, and then He looks at evil figs. And the good figs were those that went into captivity. they went into Babylon. The evil figs did not. And that is one way God is saying that those that come out of the churches, figuratively what it is, that go into Babylon, they are like the good figs. Those that are saved that come out of the churches. And those that remain are like evil figs, because they never went into captivity. They never came out of the church. They remain. Well, the verse later in Jeremiah 8 is verse 20. And it says here, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. The harvest is past and the summer is ended. Now, since we're approaching Labor Day, this is the unofficial end of summer, isn't it? Of course, it doesn't end until September 20th or 21st, actually. But and also, let me be clear that I'm going to be talking about two types of summer. One is the season that we're familiar with, you know, summer, fall, winter, spring, the cycle, and then it goes back to summer. Well, now we're coming to the end of summer, the end of the last summer that will ever be like this. This is the last summer anyone, we could say, would go on vacation. Because even though there will be another cycle, the world will remain at this time next year. It'll still be here. And I'm sure the temperature will probably be similar. So you could have a summer season, but no one's going to be thinking about vacation or boardwalk or beaches or any of that kind of thing at that time, because the world, really as we know it, will no longer be here. It'll be the 5 months, into the 5 months of torment, of great sorrow, and the last thing on anyone's mind will be sunning themselves on the beach. That's not going to happen ever again after. Now I have to also be careful, because there are places in the world, Florida, California, and they have nice weather. I'm just looking at this from the normal cycle in climates like our own, that we have this summer season, and this is it. And, you know, anybody else get a little melancholy? Anybody else get a little melancholy about this whole business of the end of the world? And, I mean, you just find yourself thinking about seasons, about life as we have known it. And for instance, you know, the beach has always been one of my favorite places to be. To go down the shore, to be on the boardwalk, to hear the sounds and to see the sights, to hear the ocean waves coming against the shore. Or to hear the seagulls flying around the boardwalk, or today they're like stationed outside McDonald's, but they still fly around the boardwalk at times, and they go onto the beach, and you hear that gull sound, and kids can do it pretty good. Mine, 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 or how's that go? I don't know, but to see all these things. And I remember when I was a kid, that was, it was like happiness, as much happiness as I knew as a kid. When it came time, June, July, or August, I can't remember exactly when I was little, but we got in the car, and at that time there was long traffic jams to get down to the shore. It took a couple of hours, at least 3 hours, and we went down, and to experience the beach, to experience the ocean, to experience, you know, all the sights and sounds that are there. It's pleasant memories. And then also, when I've grown up, and, you know, I have a family and I have children, I've taken my children down to the shore, down to the beach, and sat down and dug in the sand with them. I remember when they were little, and they would bring their Tonka trucks, and we make roads, and you go into these big wide holes you're building, And that was really very happy times, joyful times. Well, you know, what God is telling us is, I think in this verse, that the summer is ended, the summer is over. All that's over. We have a few more days, but that's it. That's it. It's never going to be that way again. And it's a sorrowful thing that this is coming to pass, that the harvest is past, the summer is ended. Now, the summer has ended almost physically, but actually spiritually it will not end for a little while longer. Now, let's go to Matthew 24. Matthew 24 and verse 32, which says, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree, when his branch is yet tender, and putteth forth leaves. Ye know that summer is nigh or near." When the fig tree, when the branch is tender and putteth forth leaves. Now we're talking about how God illustrates salvation through fields and harvests and crops. And now he's talking about a fig tree. And he actually tells us right up front, he doesn't always do that, this is a parable. This is a parable. So I'm not talking about a real fig tree. I'm not talking about a tree that brings forth the fruit of figs, actually. This represents something. And what does it represent? Well, it represents national Israel. National Israel is what the fig tree represents. And, it's really an amazing thing that Israel is in the land of Palestine now. They're over there in the Middle East, a nation amongst the nations of the world again. That's an incredible thing. Now, I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 1961. And then when I began becoming aware, you know how you start to look around you in this world and you become cognizant of many different things. And for all I knew, my whole life, Israel was there. They were there. They became a nation in 1948. And so in the late 60s, 70s, they were a nation. That was nothing unusual to me. But we can tend to forget, because they've been there 62 years now, that if you go back in history, in the first century A.D., they were destroyed by the Romans and scattered all over the earth. They weren't a nation anymore after the first century. And then you go hundreds of years, if you go up to the days of the Reformation, when Luther and Knox and Calvin and all those guys were protesting the Catholic Church. Well, Israel wasn't a nation at that time. If you go to the 17th century, 1611, when the King James Bible was written, Israel wasn't a nation at that time. If you go to 1776, when America declared its independence and we became a nation, an independent nation, Israel wasn't a nation at that time. Or if you go to the Civil War, the American Civil War of 1865, Israel was not a nation at that time. For about 1900 years, from the first century AD, they were not a nation amongst the nations of the world. But God, He works incredibly in events and orchestrates all things. His divine providence is behind everything, really. Things he allows, things he brings to pass. And he allowed the Nazis in World War II to kill millions of Jews. He took his hand of restraint off of people. And that just shows you what man is capable of if God removes that hand of restraint to any degree. And today he's doing it with sins all across the face of the earth, like homosexuality and all the sins that are listed in Romans chapter 1. He's lifting that hand back. But he could do that at any time. He could keeps someone faithful, like Abimelech, so he doesn't touch Sarah. He could make sure from the integrity of his heart he would not get involved in adultery. Or he could move it back a little bit and allow men to do what men would do if God were not restraining sin. And so the Germans, they just in hatred and out of the heart of man, the evil heart of man, they built the concentration camps and they gassed millions, estimated about 6 million Jews and others. They were killed by the Nazis in World War II, and that war ended in 1945. And it really set the atmosphere for just 3 years later, in 1948, for much sympathy to be showed toward the Jewish people, and also the formation of the United Nations. At that time, they were in support in England. The British Empire was very instrumental in getting Israel back into the land of Palestine in order to form a nation once again. That's incredible that after about 1900 years, this people, and they were scattered across the face of the earth. I mean, even the Epistle of James writes to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. They were scattered across the face of the earth, but that awful destruction at the hands of the Nazis in the death camps really brought them back together, and they were determined not to let that happen again. And so they were willing to go into the hostile atmosphere of the Middle East with enemies all around in order to form a nation once again. And God is saying here in Matthew 24 that we should learn a parable of the fig tree. We should, this is a similar way of saying, like he says in 2 Peter 3, Beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing. That is, learn it. Learn it. Don't be ignorant of it. And learn the parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, no fruit. No fruit. They've been back there 62 years. They have not gotten an inch closer to recognizing Christ as Messiah. They have not made any step in that direction to realizing that Jesus was eternal God. And so there can be no fruit, of course, if you don't recognize Christ as Savior. And God is saying, though, here's one big thing that all of us can learn. When we see the fig tree in leaf with no fruit, we can know summer is near. Summer is near. And now let's look at a few proverbs. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 6. And it says in verse 6, Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. Now that's similar to Jeremiah 8, where it said in Jeremiah 8, verse 20, The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. It's joining summer and harvest. And so too here in Proverbs 6, as God is instructing us further, to go to the ant, thou sluggard. And who's he talking to? Who's he talking to? Any sluggards here? Well, I think we may have one maybe here. One sluggard. Me. Well, God is talking to people because we're very lazy. We're slothful. We're a sluggard. Maybe not in your job. Maybe not in your home. Maybe not in any other area of your life, but when it comes to bringing the gospel, a sluggard. That's a good description. Somebody said to me just this past week, "I'm worried about you. Are you overworked? Are you kind of asking me really? Because maybe they see me on Pal Talk or they see me do this." And I said, "Well, tell you what, you know, when I stop wasting time, when I can look back on a day and not see large portions of it wasted." Then I'll say, yeah, I'm maybe a little overworked, but I definitely am very able to waste time even now, even today, even knowing how short the time is. I can look back on a day and I can see time that I've wasted. And why is it? Well, see, God knows us better than we know ourselves because we have a tendency to being a sluggard. Now he says, go to the ant, consider her ways, and be wise. If you look at Proverbs 30, it says in a similar proverb, in verse 24, there be four things which are little upon the earth, but they are exceeding wise. The ants are a people, not strong, yet they prepare their meat in the summer. The ants are a people, a wise people. That's unusual to speak of ants that way, but God is using them to typify who? But the believers. The wise will understand. None of the wicked will understand. I will give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist. Five wise virgins prepared themselves for their Lord's coming. The five foolish didn't have oil in their lamps. In many ways, God shows us that wisdom is extremely important at this time because wisdom is that understanding that He gives of the Scripture concerning the end of the world and all the other things we're learning as God has opened up the Bible to reveal these truths. So when we're reading about the ant in Proverbs 6, that we should consider her ways and be wise, well, we also can look at ants in our yards or wherever we're at, and we see they always seem like they're busy. They always seem like they're working. You never see an ant, for instance, I was just talking about the beach. You never see ants laying back and kicking their feet up and relaxing. You don't see ants do that. You see them scurrying around. They scurry this way, then they scurry that way. And what are they doing? Well, God is saying they're gathering their meat. They're preparing for harvest. The harvest. And they're gathering meat during this time of harvest. And they're preparing for a time when the meat will not be able to be found. And then says in verse 7 of Proverbs 6, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler. And, you know, we've looked at that before, how it does fit the true believer today, because there's no pastor, there's no elder, there's no deacon, there's no spiritual authority over the believers. There's no one to organize everyone. There's no one to oversee what Tony's doing from what Gary's doing. Tony goes up and down the East Coast. Gary feels led to go to Toronto. There's no one organization, no man who is directing all these things. There's a lot of things happening we don't know anything about. There's a group going to Argentina September 7th for a week. I just found out a little while ago. Nobody announced it. Nobody said anything. Believers are all over the world. And God is the one. God is the one who is directing their course. Remember what it says also in Proverbs, that a king's heart is in the hand of the Lord and he turneth it whithersoever he will, as the rivers of water. So he directs one believer that way to the east coast, another believer to the west coast, and or here locally, some go down that street, others go up the street, and no one is orchestrating it all. Only God is doing it, and even though we're sluggards, God is moving within His people at this time to work. You know, there's a great task. We have that enormous task of warning the world as a watchman, of telling the world that judgment day is close at hand, and God's people are beginning go here and go there, to use their resources, to use their time, to use their money, to use whatever it is they can think of in order to bring the gospel to the people of the world before it ends, before it's over. Now, if you also go to Proverbs 10, it says in verse 5, "He that gathereth in summer is a wise son, but he that sleepeth in harvest is a son that causes shame." Summer, harvest. Gather or sleep. What are you doing? What have you been up to? That's, I think, what God would want to know. He would want to know of each one of us. We're all servants, and we all have a task that is given us, just like Abraham sent his servant to get a wife for his son Isaac after his mother Sarah died. He sent that servant, and that servant was very faithful and did what his master Abraham wanted him to do. He didn't go off to the left. He didn't go off to the right. He was also in constant prayer that God would direct his steps, and he did. The Lord led him right to the water at the time Rebekah was coming out with her pitcher, at the time that the young ladies came out to bear water for their households. And God led his servant there, and we know that God is leading his people, his servants, to bring the gospel to the world at this time, because he's told us to occupy until he come. And another verse is Proverbs 26, and verse 1 says, "As snow in summer and as rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool." Again, summer, harvest. And we're seeing they're basically synonyms. They're synonyms. They go hand in hand. God could speak of the summer, and he's referring to the harvest. It's the same thing. And so when we read in Matthew 24:32 about the fig tree being in leaf, you can know that summer is near. Harvest is near. It's the time for the husbandman, after he receives the latter rain, to immediately put in the sickle to gather his crop, all the precious fruit of the earth, and to take it up into his presence in heaven. And that's what God is saying. But it again, going back to Jeremiah 8, verse 20, "The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved." When will the summer be ended? Yeah, it's Labor Day coming up. It's Labor Day. Or just in a couple more weeks, this summer will be over. But spiritually, the summer will be over May 21 of 2011. The harvest will be over then. No more after that point. No one else will become saved after that point. No more rain. The latter rain is gone. Remember what God said in Zechariah 14 concerning the Feast of Tabernacles? In verse 16, "And shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King Jehovah of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, And it shall be that whoso will not come up, that's rapture language, whosoever will not come up of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem, that's heavenly Jerusalem, to worship the King, Jehovah of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not that have no rain, there shall be the plague wherewith Jehovah will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. On May 21, God collects His people and He brings them up into heaven in order to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles will conclude on October 21, 2011. That's the last day of the feast. That's the day that God has determined to destroy the world. Some people have a wrong understanding of God's salvation plan, and they think salvation will continue up until October 21 of 2011. But it won't. It won't. They think this because John 7 says in verse 37, in that last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. And they're saying, well, you see, Jesus is making or sending forth the gospel one last time at the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles, and that will be October 21. So obviously, there's salvation up until the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. And yet, that's not true. That's not true. God said in Exodus 23, in verse 14, three times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in the year. Thou shalt keep the feast of unleavened bread. Thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded thee, in the time appointed of the month Abib. For in it thou camest out from Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest. Now Jesus said in Matthew 13, the harvest is the end of the world. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of thy labors. God breaks up the feast of harvest into two parts. First fruits, mentioned earlier, the 144,000. That's associated with Pentecost. The first fruits of thy labors, which thou hast sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering. Ingathering is that feast that is held at the same time as the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field. You don't collect the fruit on the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Ingathering. You bring the fruit in. Then you hold your feast. You don't send forth the gospel on the very last day, October 21. The fruit is already gathered in. It's not going to be gathered in then. Look at Deuteronomy 16. And it says in verse 13, thou shalt observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after that thou hast gathered, that's past tense, in thy corn and thy wine, and thou shalt rejoice in thy feast. Afterwards, we then will hold the Feast of Tabernacles. And that's important because God is taking His people up May 21, 5 months before the feast even begins, or a little less than 4 months and some days. The feast begins several days before October 21. But God is saying that He's going to collect His fruit. Then they go up to keep the feast where you need to be. You need to be in Jerusalem, spiritual Jerusalem. You can't be on the earth. If you're on the earth, you can't keep the feast. All there is no rain, is what God says. The latter rain is over. It will cease to fall on May 21. And if the rain isn't falling, well, there can be no more salvation. There can be no more fruit. There can be no more deliverance of any kind. And so, what is God saying in Jeremiah 8, verse 20? The harvest... I have such a great memory. The harvest... I'm not serious about that. The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. So some people are going to experience that. They're going to realize that. Because the harvest has come. The sickle was put in. The fruit was gathered and taken up and out of this world. There's dead everywhere lying ungathered. It's rotten fruit. It's sending forth now a literal stench in all the earth because the dead are laying out. Many will die on that first day from earthquakes worldwide. And they will definitely give an appearance. It's a good analogy of rotten fruit, of corrupt fruit, of fruit that God had no use for because He never saved them. And so this verse is telling us, just like this, summer is coming to an end. It's a little preview. In just a few days, this summer is ending. This physical summer, this season is coming to its close. And not too long after that, we're going to come to the close of the spiritual summer, the spiritual harvest, and that's it. That's it. There'll be no more time. There'll be no more opportunity. Now, here it said, finally, we are not saved. That's the realization that sets in to anyone who's left behind. Now, that's why their cry is, Lord, Lord. That's why there's torment for so many, because they thought in their relationship to Christianity that they would be raptured, that they would go into heaven. And yet they remain, and it's very obvious, they were not saved. Now today is still the day of salvation. It's still possible. Still possible, and there's still great hope. Right now, there is tremendous hope for God to save His people. And we don't know who they are. And so there's hope now for someone to use this time to go to God and say, Oh Lord, I love the summer season, but now it's gone. And I know very quickly the open door will be shut. And the possibility of salvation for maybe me or my family or my friends or my neighbors or anyone will end. And so could you have mercy? And could you grant me your salvation? And let's just stop here and close with a word of prayer.